IRIB English Radio.
Tehran slams Western countries for supporting and participating in the annual meeting of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization terror group. U.S. forces came under attack, a mortar attack that is in the Syrian province of Deir ez-Zor, the latest in a series of attacks on American troops in Iraq and Syria in recent days. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says Israel has demolished over 420 Palestinian homes, that is, in 2021. Welcome to the program. Tehran slams Western countries for supporting and participating in the annual meeting of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization terror group. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the MKO is a terrorist cult that has the blood of Iranian people on its hands. Said Khatibzadeh slammed Western politicians, including former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, for, quote, selling themselves to the Europe-hosted circus. He accused the West of a shameful hypocrisy driven by insatiable thirst for money and anti-Iran obsession. The MKO's three-day virtual meeting, which began in Paris Saturday, is attended by Pompeo and several U.S. lawmakers, as well as Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša. Every year, the event brings together delegates paid by the terror group. The MKO has carried out assassination and bombing campaigns against Iranians since the country's Islamic Revolution of 1979.
The Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization was founded in the 1960s. The group started the blind assassination campaign of Iranian citizens and officials after the 1979 Islamic Revolution in a bid to overturn the Islamic establishment and control the country. They also conducted dozens of bombings across Iran. Out of nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the group's acts of terror. Former Iranian President Mohammad Ali Rajoi and ex-Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Bahonar are among those killed in the MKO terror attacks. The group is also responsible for a massive blast targeting the headquarters of the Islamic Republic Party on June 28, 1981 in Tehran. At least 72 senior Iranian officials and lawmakers, including then-Judiciary Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Ali Beheshti, lost their lives in the bombing. The MKO is also behind a failed assassination attempt on the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in 1981. During a war launched against Iran by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, MKO members were armed by then the Iraqi regime and prepared them to fight alongside Ba'athist forces against the Islamic Republic. Despite all crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the US, that often claim to be against any form of terrorism, rather removed the MKO from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012 respectively. Ever since, the West has changed its stance toward the MKO, propagating it not only as an Iranian opposition group, but misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor. The MKO throws lavish conferences every year in the French capital Paris, with well-known American, Western, and Saudi figures in attendance as guests of honor. Some of these figures who attend these events include former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former Mayor of New York City Rudy Giuliani, former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and former Saudi spy chief Prince Turki bin Faisal Al Saud. The MKO is currently based in Albania, where it enjoys freedom of activities despite being involved in taking thousands of innocent Iranian lives and plotting terrorist attacks for decades.
Political commentator Zafar Bangish says Western countries will support and finance any terrorist group that advances their agenda.
Basically, what this reflects is the hypocrisy that exists in the West. Any terrorist that advances the West's agenda against its perceived enemies, the West would support them. We find this situation with the MKO terrorists that have been used by the West against the Islamic Republic of Iran for decades, as well as we see this similar situation with ISIS terrorists in Syria, Iraq, and other places that are doing the West's dirty work. So it is very revealing that on the one hand, while Western regimes, whether it's in the United States, Britain, France, Germany, etc., on the one hand, they talk about human rights and the right to life, and on the other hand, they finance and propagate the propaganda of this terrorist organization that has perpetrated horrendous crimes against the people of Iran, including the assassination of leading figures of the Islamic Revolution. So essentially, the MKO is used by the West, and in particular by the United States, as an instrument or a tool in order to undermine the Islamic Republic of Iran.
U.S. forces have come under fire in the eastern Syrian province of Deir ez-Zor. A war monitor said a mortar shell landed in the Conoco gas field where American troops are stationed. A U.S. military official said the incident left no casualties or damage. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. American troops have recently been targeted in Syria following last month's U.S. airstrikes against resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. Washington hasn't obtained Damascus's permission to deploy troops in Syria. The Syrian government has denounced U.S. takeover of the Arab country's oil fields. Syria hails the adoption of a resolution by the UN for the continued entry of humanitarian aid into the country through Turkey. The Syrian foreign minister described the resolution as an achievement, saying it involves all aspects which Western countries refuse to include. Faisal Mehrdad stressed that the delivery of aid must take place from inside Syria and not only through border crossings. He said the resolution also gets Syria to be aware of everything which enters the country and where this aid is going, making it difficult for the Western countries to pass weapons to terrorists. The UN Security Council on Friday extended aid activity at the Bab al-Hawa border crossing with Turkey, through which essential humanitarian supplies reaches Syria. A new report by the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says Israel has demolished over 420 Palestinian homes so far this year. The report says that hundreds of Palestinians have been displaced because of these demolitions. Earlier, on our news review program, we discussed that matter in detail.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News News Review program. And now the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says Israel has demolished over 420 Palestinian homes so far this year. The UN agency said in a report that the number included 130 donor-funded Palestinian-owned structures in the occupied West Bank. It also stated that nearly 600 people, including some 320 children, have been displaced due to these demolitions and seizure of Palestinian homes. The report indicated that the number of structures targeted has increased by 24% compared to the same period last year. Rights groups say that Israeli demolitions are part of a long-running land grab policy to make room for new settlements. And now joining us for the program is Mr. Yves Engler, author and activist from Montreal, and Mr. Jim Cavanaugh, analyst from the polemicist.net, joining us out of New York. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Jim, we'll start with you there. Your initial thoughts on this.
Well, we've seen now a horrible extension of the Israeli home demolition and home seizure. It's an ethnic cleansing project. This has become obvious to everybody in the world. You know, I saw a demolition yesterday. When you see something like this, of a Palestinian home, the home of a Palestinian prisoner, okay? If you did this in the United States, if you said, we're going to demolish the homes of black prisoners in the United States, there would be an outcry that you couldn't believe. But the American government and American politicians put up with this in Israel and support it. And I think everybody has seen that this is an attempt, ongoing attempt, not only in the occupied territories now, but in Israel itself, with Palestinian Israeli citizens, ostensibly Israeli citizens, to take their homes, seize them, or demolish them, and throw families out of their homes. And it's nothing but ethnic cleansing. And it's not going to stop. The Israelis this is the paradigm of Zionism and of the Zionist project. And the settlers say it. We're going to take this home and this neighborhood, then we're going to go to the next neighborhood, and we're going to get rid of all the Palestinian Arabs and replace them with Jewish settlers.
Thank you, Neves. Welcome to the program there. Your initial thoughts on how so many Western capitals, you hear their leaders, they try to help the Israelis justify, or oftentimes the farthest they'll take it is not say anything at all, but they will never condemn. And even when they do, there's nothing with any real teeth to it. So why is it that there's this blatant double standards when it comes to the way Palestinians, especially some of the downtrodden Palestinians, you've seen the Bedouins, their schools, their homes, I mean, they've been living a couple hundred years either in mud or tents. You have the heart to kick these people and make them homeless, more homeless than they can. You know, they're basically living pretty rough as it is, and basically no one says anything, especially, you know, Ottawa or Washington, Paris, London. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, the Canadian government is deeply complicit in the whole process, right? When the Jewish National Fund of Canada, that's a registered charity in this country, builds on the remnants of Palestinian homes, the Canadian government effectively provides, a subsidy for that through its tax credits. The JNF has been involved in taking Bedouins' homes, land, and JNF is, exclusive, only allows Jewish people to live on the land they control. So the Canadian government is completely complicit in this process from A to Z, and it's a matter of people that are of conscience within Canada, within the U.S., that oppose this, because it's not really just an Israeli policy; it's a U.S.-Canadian Israeli policy. The depth of the complicity at the diplomatic level, at the economic level, military level is such that our governments are part of this dispossession process.
And Jim, would you like to weigh in on that? Is there any level of humanitarian, of a criminal, of international law that the Israeli regime could commit against Palestinians that will not be condoned by its Western allies?
Not by the United States, not by the major political leadership of both political parties, not by the major media. There will be, maybe they went a little too far, and yeah, we should give out some more help to the Palestinians so that the Israelis can then blow it up a couple of years later. But there's no recognition. The point is, this is an essentially horrible and criminal enterprise. It is apartheid. It is ethnic cleansing on a massive scale. And there's no recognition of the essential injustice of this. Precisely the opposite. There's the assumption enforced in the media and educational institutions that there's essential justice on the side of the Israelis for some reason. And that really colors everything. Plus, there's an enormous amount of money and support that goes to the Zionist cause and to politicians who support it. You have, a dozen Congress people who, talked about signing on to a bill to condition aid to Israel, like it is on any other country, on human rights violations, etc. And 75% of the Congress said, no, we must never condition aid to Israel. It's going to be very hard to change that. Every congressman, Republican or Democrat, knows that if they come out in criticism of Israel, let alone in criticism of Zionism, they're going to get primaried with a lot of money behind their behind their opposition, and with the media overwhelmingly against them. So this is a very hard nut to crack in the United States, although things are changing. And you can say things now that they really didn't want to hear even a couple of years ago, but now they have to let them be said. Words like apartheid and colonialism and ethnic cleansing are coming into the public vocabulary.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Pleasure to have you both on. Yves Engler from Montreal and Mr. Jim Cavanaugh there joining us from New York. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Italian riot police clash with protesters trying to reach the venue of the G20 finance ministers meeting in the city of Venice. More than 250 policemen were dispatched to prevent possible violence by the demonstrators. A number of arrests were also made. The protesters voiced anger at the finance ministers and their policies. In their first face-to-face meeting since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, the G20 ministers endorsed a deal to put the minimum corporate tax rate at 15%. The move is expected to bring back billions of dollars of funds to governments straining under the pandemic. And now an opinion poll shows that a majority of Brazilians support impeaching President Jair Bolsonaro. According to the survey conducted by Datafolha, 54% of Brazilians support a proposed move by the country's lower house to open impeachment proceedings, while 42% are against it. People have been holding protests across the nation for months now, slamming the president's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Last week, a Supreme Court judge authorized an investigation into Bolsonaro for dereliction of duty over procuring an Indian COVID-19 vaccine. Suspicions of overpricing and corruption related to the contract have been cited for the allegation. Brazil has the world's second highest COVID death toll, with nearly 533,000 fatalities. On Saturday, Brazil registered more than 48,000 new daily cases with over 1,200 deaths.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It's no accident that the United States of America experienced more COVID-19 deaths in 2020 than any other country, and one of the world's highest per capita death rates. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Stephen H. Wolf, author. This article is published under the heading, COVID-19 pandemic may be winding down, but Americans are still sick and dying. Stay tuned for more. It's no accident that the United States of America experienced more COVID-19 deaths in 2020 than any other country and one of the world's highest per capita death rates. We can and should blame the nation's bungled response, but a U.S. health disadvantage predates and extends far beyond COVID-19. Unless we understand and address the root causes of what's ailing Americans, the American people will continue to experience greater illness and early death for years to come. In 2013, Americans led a cross-national study for the National Research Council and Institute of Medicine. The report, U.S. Health in International Perspective, Shorter Lives, Poorer Health, documented how Americans, even the most advantaged ones, are less healthy and dying earlier compared to people in other rich nations. evidence of a large and growing U.S. health disadvantage extends back to 1980s and persists to this day. U.S. life expectancy dropped below the OECD average in 1998 and has since fallen further behind. By 2010, the life expectancy of Americans stopped improving altogether, plateauing until 2014 and then decreasing for three consecutive years, while it continued to climb in peer nations. By 2018, the U.S. ranked 46th in life expectancy worldwide, according to the World Bank. With the arrival of COVID-19 in late 2019, its global spread in 2020 and its devastating effects on human mortality, life expectancy was bound to fall in many nations. But the extent of the decline in the U.S. has been shocking. Recently published a study co-authored with Ryan Masters shows that in 2020, U.S. life expectancy plunged 1.9 years, a drop not seen since the Second World War. This decline was 8.5 times greater than the average experienced by 16 other high-income nations, further widening cross-national life expectancy gap. In American communities of color, the drop was even more alarming. Compared to a decrease of 1.4 years among white Americans, life expectancy among black and Hispanic Americans fell 3.3 years and 3.9 years, respectively. Years of progress in narrowing black-white mortality gap were erased, and the Hispanic population, which has historically enjoyed longer life expectancy than whites, saw that advantage almost entirely erased. Unfortunately, data limitations prevented scientists from estimating changes for other important groups, including Native Americans, whose health and survival rates are among the worst in the nation. So how can this country prevent these excess deaths? Certainly not by spending more on healthcare, given that Americans already outspend every other country and still die prematurely. Healthcare, while essential, accounts for no more than 20% of health outcomes. The solutions extend beyond medicine. Epidemiologists, public health experts, and social scientists have long understood that their living conditions, the so-called social detriment of health, determine whether they live long, healthy, productive lives. The risk for disease and injury are strongly influenced by education, income, housing, neighborhoods, and workplaces, of course. Living conditions that preserve health and promote well-being are simply lacking for too many Americans. Against a backdrop of growing income and wealth inequality, many families go without essential resources and basic protections, including education and training, good jobs, steady income, safe and affordable housing, and community services to help families raise children and support youth, older adults, and people with disabilities. A new National Academy's report found that death rates are increasing among Americans in the prime of life. At ages 25 to 64, when many are working, raising children, and caring for dependents. This means that, in addition to the many other challenges they face, American children and youth are now more likely to lose a parent and need bereavement care. The implications of these trends for families, communities, employers, and nation's economy and national security are enormous, but the solutions are no mystery. Curbing the decline in health of Americans requires adequate and equitable investments in children, education, jobs that pay a living wage, and affordable housing. Health depends on conditions outside the door, such as clean air, green space, strong social networks, and services for individuals and families with social, economic, and health needs. What distinguishes other countries with better health outcomes are sensible and equitable investments in people and places. And racial inequities have haunted this nation for generations. Let's be clear, it's racism, not race, that drives racial health disparities such as higher death rates from COVID-19 and dozens of other diseases. The steep declines in the survival of black and brown Americans that study reports are not explained by skin color, but instead reflect the systematic racism that permeates almost every aspect of life in this country, including health. People discomfited by the notion of systematic racism often blame its victims for lacking personal responsibility, but racial disparities are less about the choices people make than the choices society gives them. The end of the pandemic will bring relief to many Americans, but it will not end America's health and survival crisis. The good news is that solving the U.S. health disadvantage does not require a new slate of policy proposals, but a greater focus on those currently under debate. Policies to create jobs, expand infrastructure, invest in human capital, and address systematic racism will do more to address the U.S. health disadvantage than anything doctors or hospitals might do. The reverse is also true. Failure to act, not building an economy for the 21st century centered on people and justice, will condemn American children to shorter lives and poorer health, and diminish the future of the entire country.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and let us reflect upon what the Prophet's ninth infallible successor, Imam Muhammad al-Taghi al-Jawad, peace be upon him, has said about what God revealed to one of the prophets for the guidance of mankind. Your asceticism will give you comfort. Your devotion to me will endear you to me. But did you avoid my enemies and cherish my devotees?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
The Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our regular listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the life and times of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. And I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. Once again, I'm joined by Dr. Mahdi Tarabi to give his insight on the topic of the great Satan. I'd like to say salam to him and welcome him to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, the topic of the great Satan, this was a title that was given by Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't something that was given out of emotion, given out of any, shall we say, hatred towards the Americans. This was something that was mentioned as an indication of the nature and character of what the U.S. has become in terms of this imperialistic power that seeks hegemony throughout the world. Right. So, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, your take, because of course, you know, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been at the brunt of, you know, hostility of the great Satan, and for a variety of reasons, principally because you got rid of its good friend the Shah here in Iran, and secondly, the students overtook an embassy, I remember, just a few months after the victory of the revolution.
I was very young at that time.
Yes, but we were very young at that time, and wish we had participated also in the overtake of that embassy, which was called the Den of Espionage, as I remember it. And I remember Jimmy Carter panicking on the television screens about, you know, the hostage crisis, wasn't it? You know, 444 days when this espionage staff was, you know, held here in Iran. And, of course, that led to a lot of tensions between the Islamic Republic and the great Satan, the USA. But your take since then, and about, you know, the Imam's great insight and depth into in terms of giving, you know, these kinds of terms for the U.S., because, of course, he wanted to make the Muslims understand that who is their real enemy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think that's good what you said in terms of, you know, making people understand who the real enemy is.
Yes.
I think at that time, let's start it with this way.
Yes.
Okay. Just as a matter of principle, obviously Imam, you know, was very calculating in terms of, he was very careful in what he said.
He was, yes.
He wasn't somebody who was given to, you know, and you can see the tapes and you can watch the films from back then.
When he said something, he meant it.
Right. Mm. He wasn't these people that would just, you know, come out with some statements.
Some rhetorical flourishes while he's,
you know.
Yeah,
He spoke quietly, calmly.
Right.
And, you know, he was a man of 80, so,
yes, he was,
you know, he wasn't really going to get up and,
yeah, exactly,
you know, do an imitation of Mussolini or whatever, you know, or Hitler in terms of, you know,
no.
So when he says something,
yes,
there's a basis for it.
There's a wisdom in it.
Right. Yeah. So why would Imam use the term great Satan?
Satan, yes. I mean, that was extraordinary at the time.
Right.
I mean, it took us all aback.
For the U.S.
Yes.
And I think really it has to do with, if you read the Quran,
yes,
and you are a little bit familiar with the way Shaitan
is described in
the Quran and in the Islamic sources,
sure,
you will see Shaitan is somebody who deceives, is somebody who tries to lead people astray.
Yes. And is also very arrogant.
Right.
There were qualities here that
right.
would be
I
described.
I mean, this is before he... If you see the first time it's mentioned, which is Baqarah,
yes,
Surah Baqarah, when they, you know, it's the beginning of Surah Baqarah.
That's right.
When they talk about him not bowing down to Adam, Hazrat Adam.
Yes. Because he disobeyed Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Peace be upon him, in terms of, you know, Allah giving that order.
Order, yes.
That you should, you know, bow down to your...
And he became one of the mustakbirin, one of the...
To the prophet and the imam of your age.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. Well, there's a good point, isn't right. there?
And exactly, this is the point I was going to make, is that in
precisely.
The ayah, before it talks about him being kafir and denier of truth, he talks about him being mustakbir and takabbur and being arrogant.
Arrogant.
And remember, shaitan is a person who, or is a, you know, entity which 6,000 years, according to the Rivayat, has been constantly praising and worshipping God.
Exactly. Yes.
You know, that's absolutely more than any of us.
Yeah, of course.
Right?
Yes.
6,000 years of...
That's more than a Glaswegian, because we only live till 50.
Exactly. So, you know, these are things that, you know, we should remember. Yes. When he says great Satan, he's talking about Satan and Shaitan coming from that Quranic, Islamic background and that way of describing to us who Shaitan is.
Exactly.
It is a person who's arrogant. It is a person who disobeys the command of his Lord.
Sure.
It is a, you know, being that is so arrogant that it will not recognize the Imam of its age.
Exactly.
And its job is to lead people astray.
Exactly.
This is because he asked God for you know, once God decides that, you know, now that you've disobeyed, I'll have to take care of you. He says, well, give me time until the end of times.
Sure.
See how many people I can...
How much of the progeny of Adam I can destroy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And God says, okay.
Fine. Go ahead.
Let's see what you can do.
Do, yes.
And of course, Allah also in the Quran, in many places, talks about the people who are mukhlisin, the people who are you know, worshiping and praising Allah, you know, sincerely.
Yes.
They are immune to these.
To this entity.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So it's not a, you know, some sort of a injustice by Allah to do this.
No.
In fact, Satan himself is a tool of Allah and does it with the permission of Allah.
Exactly.
It's not like in the Christian way of, because this is the problem we have, is we when we speak about religion in English, we immediately are using the words with that baggage that comes from Christianity.
That's
in terms of, you know, Satan having independent powers of God or being some sort of a dark force, you know.
Opposite to God. It's not like that.
There is no opposite to God.
No, there isn't. There's just God. Yes.
And everything happens within his plan. And part of his plan is to have Satan. An entity like the Satan. And we even have Shayateen talking about different Satans.
Yes, that's right. Different Satans, yes.
You know, we have Iblis.
Yes.
Which is, you know.
Yes. We also have our internal Satans as
right.
well.
Right. So this the ayah that I was talking about is actually referring to Iblis.
Very good.
Which is, you know, the main Shaitan.
The main Shaitan. The arch Shaitan, yes.
Right?
As the U.S. has today.
Right.
Yes.
So this is the point that, you know, it's basically... And it's interesting. I think this is a very interesting subject to actually think about.
Mm.
You have, again, in the Quran, Shaitan talking about how... And the Quran describes it, how on the Day of Judgment, Shaitan will renounce all the people that he led astray. And he will say, all I did was obey my Lord.
Exactly.
So, you know.
That's right. Because he had his permission to do that in the first place. And then he says, well,
I'm not, you're not from me. I praise the Lord.
Yeah, that's right. And he said, well, they did that of their own free will. I mean, I had no power over them. I couldn't control them.
So, you know, Shaitan is a very interesting...
He is a very interesting character.
Right.
And not somebody I'd like to associate that.
Right. And I'm simply saying interesting in the sense that, you know, it's interesting to look at his place within this divine...
plan.
Within this divine structure.
Yes.
So, given all that, this was all an introduction in terms of why would
Imam Khomeini, God bless his soul, use this term. Yes,
right.
Exactly.
It wasn't, as you correctly pointed out, simply a rhetorical flourish or some sort of emotional...
response
to
something.
Right.
Yeah.
It was a very clear statement of the nature and the essence of who we're dealing with.
Dealing with, yes.
Okay. And I would add something to that, which is that a big part, or maybe the... And it's very interesting that we recently had this discussion again in the media. Americans, because of their Protestant background, because of their whole biblical way of looking at things, I'm talking about initially when America was...
That's true,
was started.
You're quite right,
and
sir.
And this coming out of Britain and coming out of the different dissident movements within the Protestant movements in England...
That's correct, yes.
They have this belief that they are chosen people.
They do. You know, it's pretty much interesting how that's
right.
in line
and
with Israel.
This is something that's been discussed by academics, so this is not... I'm not saying anything new here.
No, you're not.
There's a whole set of literature on this matter that Protestants consider themselves to be the chosen people. That, you know, you had the Israelites and the Bani Israel initially, then you had, you know, the church, and then after the church, I'm talking about the Catholic Church.
That's right, yes. That's
and
right.
Once the Catholic Church went astray, then it was
the
you
Protestants.
Know, the burden fell onto the Protestants.
Yes, that's correct, yes.
To take on God's, you know.
I mean, this is very interesting because I've heard this a lot, even in the UK, you know,
right.
That they do describe the US as being an apocalyptic nation in the sense that they're coming out of something right out of the Bible.
Well, what I was going to add is that
yeah.
Once that aspect of things, in the 20th century where you have this kind of secularization happening,
yes.
It becomes something else. It's called, they don't say we're chosen people anymore. They
no.
Say we're the exceptional nation.
The exceptional nation.
Exceptionalism.
Yes, yes,
this is exactly what Putin and Obama were arguing about. I don't know if you remember, Putin wrote,
that's
the,
right, yes,
wrote the article.
Putin wasn't very happy about
and
that.
And he said, you know, we don't have exceptional nations.
No.
We all, you know, ask for forgiveness from the Lord. Okay?
Yes, yes. And we all have to make do on this planet.
Right.
Yes.
And so basically, and this is a big debate within the U.S., one of the things that the Republicans and the conservatives criticized Obama for during the first round that he was running was when they asked Obama, is America an exceptional nation? He really didn't give a very, you know, patriotic answer to that. He said, well, we're exceptional just as other nations are exceptional in their own way.
Yeah.
Gingrich had a whole book about it, how, you know, this shows that Obama is not really understanding what American civilization is and we are the exceptional nation.
Sure.
All that. This is, you know, in his first term. We get to the point in Syria where he basically, the only thing he could say about why they want to bomb Syria is, and this was in the press conference, the initial press conference
sure.
that he announced that he
sure.
was going to do this. He said, well, in the end, we're going to do this because we're America.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
You remember?
Yes, I remember.
We're America, yes. And America has to do
this.
America
has to do this.
Right. We are the only ones that can do this. We're the ones that have this responsibility.
Yeah.
Because we're an exceptional nation. We're different than the others.
Mm.
Okay?
Sure.
Now, when did Imam talk about this stuff?
Oh, my goodness. We are way back.
78?
Yes.
Yes.
I think so. 78, 79, yes.
Right. So, alhamdulillah, thank God, we see the world is coming to where
yes.
Imam was
years ago.
When he says that it is the great Satan, it's more than saying you are not exceptional. It is saying that by you
very good point,
claiming
yes.
to be the exceptional nation, claiming to
excellent.
Be the chosen people,
mm-hmm.
you are arrogating something for yourself.
Self. Which you do not deserve.
And which is dangerous. Which
dangerous,
leads people
yes.
astray. Which leads people into the fire. Which leads to their destruction.
Sure.
Which leads to your own destruction.
Your own self-destruction as well.
And
that's
as
right.
such, we have to stand up against you.
Exactly.
We cannot be indifferent to you.
Yeah.
Okay? This is all, you know, and I think it's good that we're talking about these things at this moment because there's all this talk again about, you know, let's have a deal with the Americans. I'm talking about in terms of, you know,
Diplomacy
and
other things. Yeah, that's right. Yes.
And, you know, fine. Everybody does
okay.
their diplomacy.
Sure.
You know, nobody's
true.
Against diplomacy.
No.
You go, you talk, you
yes.
make your point.
And you agree to disagree.
And this is the beautiful thing that, you know, the leader always talks about, Supreme Leader always talks about, is that, you know the essence and the real identity of your enemy. This is, again, he's been talking about this in a number of speeches recently.
Point.
Where he says it's fine. He even used this the term heroic flexibility, which was a very interesting way of saying it. He said, look, you know, we talk to everyone. He used the example of a wrestler, because, you know, Iranians were wrestlers.
Of course, yeah.
And
you have a great tradition.
We beat everyone recently.
You have.
Had the world
yes.
We had the world championships.
You have. Yes.
We beat everyone again, as usual.
As usual, yes.
We even had that meet in New York in Grand Central Station where they were invited, and we beat all the Americans in the
excellent.
Wrestling. Okay, just for the record.
Just for the record.
Just
yes.
for the record. Yeah.
Thank you for me.
So when yes. the Supreme Leader uses wrestling analogies, this is something that is very, you know,
appropriate
in Iran. Everybody understands what he's talking about. And he was talking about that when a wrestler, you know, is in a clinch and is wrestling with his opponent, he might, you know, show some flexibility at times. He might let go of some area at some point. But he never forgets what he's doing.
Doing, yes.
He never forgets what the enemy is after.
After, yes.
So this is the point. I think when Imam, you know, so brilliantly and so powerfully
used this
the word
expression,
great
yes.
Satan,
yes.
he completely changed the framework in which people were looking at the United States.
Exactly.
He completely, you know, this is the great ability, this is the ability of great, you know, leaders.
Yes.
Is they don't simply enter a debate. They actually shape the debate.
They shape it.
Okay, they determine the framework
parameters in
of
which
the debate
of that debate. Yes,
his thing was not, well, you know, the Americans have been unjust to us for 50 years and they overthrew.
He said
they are the great Satan. This is our starting point.
He hit the nail on the head. That's
our starting
point.
Is you are the
great
Satan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this is, we deal with you as the great
Satan.
Whatever we have to do, we do. And it's interesting because, you know, even Imam then in his final testament writes about the fact that, and this is, I think, one of those, I mean, it's just, you know, sometimes he says things and you think, okay, you know, where did he come from?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, he was just amazing, some of the things he would say.
No, he was beyond time in that sense.
He said in his final testament, he said, you know, maybe there will come a time when we can be, when we can have relations with the United States if they change their attitude towards us. If they change their arrogance and they change their...
He did say that.
So this is something that he's leaving the door. He's basically saying, yes, you are the great Satan, but it's because of your own behavior.
Yeah.
You can have an answer. And it's interesting, in that same sentence he says, but we will never be friends with Ali Saud. This is very interesting. This was after they killed the
pilgrims in 1987. That's right. And they slaughtered the Hajj pilgrim pilgrims in that year.
Right.
That's right.
So, you know, this is interesting because what you have is is Imam basically saying this is the essence and this is the identity and this is the, you know, the characteristic
of the U.S. But you may be able to have some relations with.
This is the point about really understanding that, you know, it's all from Allah. Right?
It is.
It's
very
not
much
something
so.
That you, you know.
No, you can do from yourself. No.
Right. So we have him, you know, talking about the great Satan.
Yes.
Again, going back to the way we understand Shaitan in the Islamic sources.
Right.
And then, of course, looking at America's behavior globally.
Sure.
And isn't it interesting that these 34 years have just confirmed everything?
That's right. It's exposed America for what it is.
Isn't really America the most hated?
It is.
You know, in the nation in the world right now by other people.
Well, it's a gangster, isn't it?
Really? Isn't it something?
It's like a large Al Capone.
And remember,
you know,
at what time
the
Imam did this? Imam did this at a time when the U.S. was, you know, the great superpower.
Yes.
Standing up to the evil Soviets.
That's right.
To the godless communists.
That's right.
Right? So, you know, America had a certain
image.
Right. They even...
Defenders of the free world.
They even, you know, had done what they did in Europe in World War II and standing up to the Nazis and standing up to, you know, the different forces that existed, which were all considered to be very good things by everybody. And and they are good things.
Yes.
Of course it's good to stand up to, you know, a crazy person like Hitler.
Yes.
Okay? Of course it's good to stand up to Stalinism. So these are things that, you know, America had on its, you know,
plus
resume.
Had a plus point on its CV. Yeah.
With all the negative stuff as well, like,
sure.
you know, all the coup d'etats and the killings and the murders in Latin America and around the world.
Yeah, the ones that they wouldn't speak about necessarily.
Right,
yes.
So before World War II, all the stuff that they did in the world, they already were practicing in Latin America, so since the Monroe Doctrine, you know, started. So this was, so it's not, we're not trying to say that it was all good or all bad, but there were elements. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we see, you know, the first time the U.S. is seriously challenged in the Cold War, by a so-called third world nation, by a developing nation, is the Islamic Revolution. And, you know, isn't it beautiful that at that time, you know, it was, you know, we're neither West nor East, we're Islamic Republic.
Republic, yes.
So it wasn't like every other situation in the Cold War where if you were going to go against the U.S., you would necessarily
join
be with
the Soviet
bloc.
Yes, that's
okay?
right.
Or if you were with the Soviet Union, you were necessarily against the U.S. This is the kind of world that the Americans and the Soviets wanted.
Yeah, exactly.
And they had created to.
But Iran broke out of that
Iran
because
broke
of Islam.
Out of that complete mold, and that's why you see that.
Thanks to Imam Khomeini, God
that's why you
soul.
See the Americans and the Soviets supporting Saddam during
the
war.
Exactly.
Okay. They're giving him weapons, and everybody's supporting Saddam.
They had to contain this because
right?
this was a very dangerous idea.
Right. I mean, this was like. You know, the
this
Soviets
was toxic.
And Soviets and the Americans, hey, we need to be on this, we are together on this one. Which is, you know, just think about that for a second.
I know, it was extraordinary.
And so basically what you had, and it's funny because at that time they said, well, the Soviets are the little Satan.
Okay? Yes, that's right, they're the little Satan.
We forgot about that.
Yeah, we forgot about that.
Because the Soviets don't exist anymore, so
yes,
you know, it doesn't
right.
matter.
So. Yeah, so that's why he was little, because he was going to resign pretty
soon. So this is, there's also a point in that, which is that the main enemy...
is going to be the U.S.
Right. So it is in this environment that, you know, our dear Imam said these things.
Sure.
He framed the debate.
Mm.
He called out the U.S. and, you know, pointed out to the real identity of the U.S. and its behavior towards others.
Sure.
Again,
sure.
I repeat, when Imam talks about the great Satan, he's talking about something that's also partly in the control of the U.S. of how it behaves.
Sure.
This is not some sort of a, you know, preordained, you know.
No, it's not, no.
Where there's no influence.
Because that's very interesting that you're saying that.
Because that's not part of Islam.
Yeah, because
Everyone is capable of redemption.
Everybody, changing their behavior,
right.
That's right. So he says that if they can change their conduct, there may be some room for negotiation.
Right.
Yeah.
So the point is, again, the beautiful thing that he did is that from an Islamic perspective, he clearly drew the line.
Yes, he did.
Because we see, brother, look at how miserably Ikhwan failed in Egypt.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Why?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
They didn't understand who America was.
Exactly.
Okay?
Yeah.
So this is important Islamically.
That's right.
Okay? I'm talking now Islamically. We'll
yes,
go
because
step by step.
They made a fundamental mistake in their revolution.
What we saw, unfortunately, in these last years is that the Ikhwan, you know, didn't understand the nature of America.
No.
They thought that, well, we got the population to vote for us, so we'll, you know, we'll play everyone.
Yes.
We'll deal with the Americans. We'll keep our ambassador in Israel. We'll try to, you know, be friendly with the Americans.
Yeah, try to be everything,
you know,
to all things.
Right.
And it all went pear-shaped. Exactly.
Why? Because from the beginning, they were not able to distinguish the reality and the identity and the essence of
who is your enemy.
Who the other side is.
Yes.
What the enemy is.
Exactly.
Something which was very important and completely different when it came to the Islamic Revolution in Iran because of the leadership of somebody like Imam.
Yes.
And it's always Imam standing there
when
everybody is confused.
Yes.
And everybody's
not so sure about what to do.
What were we supposed to do? Imam saying, this is it.
And
he was always right.
He was always right.
And this is a miracle.
This is extraordinary.
I mean, you know, I'm not trying to.
No.
He's not Masoom. He's a normal human being.
You've said that in a previous program, which was a very appropriate thing that you said at the time, and a very excellent point, where you said that this comes naturally out of the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt.
Exactly.
This is something expected of us.
And
if we follow it properly, that's
the
conclusion we'd come to.
I repeat that beautiful sentence or that phrase by Shahid Sadr.
Yes, please.
You know, Ayatollah Muhammad Baghir Assad,
yes,
who was martyred by, you know,
Saddam, yes,
crazy Saddam,
yes,
where he tells his students, he says, you know, wubu, which is, you know, how would you melt into Imam,
yes,
become one with Imam,
Imam,
the way Imam has melted into has become one with Islam.
My God.
Okay,
what
so
a beautiful expression.
So Imam is completely, you know, manifestation of all those teachings, both in terms of the knowledge and in terms of acting on it.
Acting on it.
He's a manifestation of that.
He was the manifestation.
You know,
of
it's
that.
Interesting because we always use the word Ayatollah. He really is Ayatollah.
He was really Ayatollah. He was. Because
he was a sign of God.
There were books I remember that came out in the UK, you know, and it simply said the sign of God.
Right.
And there was a big portrait of Imam Khomeini. There you are.
Right. So he really was Ayatollah.
We use Ayatollah
in terms of a title.
Yes,
but he was really the Ayatollah. But then we really have Ayatollah. And, of course, all of us are Ayatollah in a certain way.
We are, but
the whole of creation is Ayatollah.
Yeah, but we're not.
But you know, he was...
Yeah.
And, you know, this is good for us to have experience because, you know, we're distant from the time of the Prophet.
Yes.
You know, when you're in the presence of a Prophet or the Imams, it's clear.
It's very, very clear.
I mean, it wasn't clear to everyone, but...
No. Of course,
you know?
I know. There were certain exceptions.
Right.
Cases,
we don't
want
to get to that.
We don't want to get to that.
But the point is that, you know, that presence already itself is maybe the biggest proof for a lot of people.
It is.
Just the presence of somebody
of
the Prophet, peace be upon him.
Yes.
Or people like Imam Ali alayhi salam or the other Imams that were there. So, and you know, we're removed from that era. And yet we see somebody, at least for me, this was the case, I'm sure it was for you.
Yes, it
those
was.
Of us
it
who,
certainly
who,
was, sir.
Who experienced Imam.
Thank God.
You know, thank God we lived to see him.
See that, yes. Because really we were very, very distant from any understanding of religion or God or even our purpose in life. And to be honest, you know, this man, you know, I mean, we don't want to use words like miracle and things like, because that's not what we're saying. We're really saying that, no, because he was living on the true teachings of Islam, he made us see what Islam
is. Right, and it was beyond, it was immediate. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was existential. It was immediate.
It was immediate, yes.
It wasn't something that...
It spoke to your soul.
It wasn't indirect. It was direct.
It was direct.
It wasn't something that was mediated. When I'm using the word immediate,
no,
I mean,
no,
it wasn't mediated.
No, no. Certainly in Glasgow, you can't get that. It really touched your soul.
Right.
It did.
It wasn't something, you know, planned or sometimes, you know, staged.
Yes.
It was genuine.
It was genuine.
It was real. You could really feel that this is coming from, you know, the source.
The source, yes. The real source, the original source.
When he would say the words, you knew that this is what was in his heart. It wasn't you know, some sort of artistic or...
No, I mean, the thing is, the media at the time, and, you know, the UK media is one of the most vicious, one of the most...
Right. The most vicious.
Nefarious type of media there is. But even they hung on every word that the Ayatollah had to say.
Right.
It was like, you know, what is he going to say the next day? They were even having, trying to anticipate that, you know, exactly what he was going to say.
And remember, we quoted from the book that we're using.
Yes.
We talked about, you know, the big crime or the big sin of Imam was that, and as the Telegraph, I think it was the Telegraph. It was the Times.
The Times
talking
the
about
Times,
you know
right.
he actually dared to tell people that they can stand up to the Americans and they can, you know, they have power.
They have power. Yeah, the people have power. Yes.
So imagine this is a society in which, you know, you have mass illiteracy, you have basically a feudal system,
sure.
You have people who have very little feeling of empowerment,
sure.
And here comes a man and he completely empowers them, and the great world power, again, I'm using the word power on purpose.
Yes.
So you have, you know, a taking away of the power. Of America and that image and calling it the great city and giving power to people who otherwise would be considered, you know, the lowest of the
lowest. Well, I mean, I think on that note, we can end this program by saying that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, never said anything without wisdom.
Exactly.
Number one. And number two, because of the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. And number two, this empowerment of the people. I mean, this was something the Imam deeply held in his heart, that he believed that civil disobedience, peaceful civil disobedience, was the way to bring down imperial powers.
And it did.
And that formula works today.
And it did.
It did.
And what you do first is you actually point out the reality of who you're dealing with.
Exactly.
And this is what he did.
Yes, and point out the true nature of your enemy. Thank you very much. And on that note, it just leaves me to thank our listeners for listening to our program today. And it leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
The light. A herd of elephants migrating in China have been making headlines for months. Now they have once again attracted attention. Experts monitoring the animals this week noticed two females engaged in a dramatic fight over the herd's leadership, where they kicked and bit each other. The tussle soon ended after a male elephant succeeded in calming the belligerent giants. The fight happened in China's southwestern province of Yunnan. The herd embarked on a lengthy journey last year after escaping a nature reserve and has since trekked hundreds of miles. The elephant's migration is the longest one in China's history. German tightrope walkers have set a new world highlining distance.